is such an odd book for so many reasons, not least of which is how it just doesn't mention a lot of things we're used to hearing in the Old Testament, like the Lord God by name, or things like it doesn't really mention the temple, it doesn't really mention the Torah, it doesn't really mention things like covenant. Although today we're going to question that sort of standard reading of the book of Esther, because today we're going to turn from our conversations yesterday, where Esther is sort of a sort of story that embraces all of creation and what can be known about God from simply looking at the world around us and the confusions it gets itself into, and looking at how Esther is in fact a Jewish story. And how, despite not having these sort of overt, really recognizable references, it has some hidden ones and some subtle ones and some things that are a bit more of an echo than anything else. And so appropriately, yesterday we got in the text to the first redemption verse, which, when this book is read aloud to celebrate the Festival of Purim once a year in synagogue, this is the verse that is, this is the first of four verses that the entire congregation joins in reading, just to get everybody back into the story, and because this is where the hero appears. So we got to chapter 2, verse 5, and the introduction of Mordecai, our hero. And if you don't mind, why don't we go ahead and start with verses 5 through 7, just to remind ourselves of these people who have now appeared, who are going to make this strange story into a very Jewish story. So if somebody's there and wants to read in a loud voice, verses 5 through 7.
Now there was a Jew in the citadel of Susa whose name was Mordecai, son of Jair, son of Shimea, son of Kish, a Benjaminite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with King Jeconiah of Judah, whom King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon had carried away. Mordecai had brought up Adassa, that is Esther, his cousin, for she had neither father nor mother. The girl was fair and beautiful, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai adopted her as his own daughter.
Thank you. So these are actually some of the most straightforward Jewish references in the book. I mean, Mordecai is introduced as a Jew, and his family names include Jair, Shimei, Kish, and the tribe of Benjamin, which we noticed at the end of our hour yesterday, ties him very closely to the biblical King Saul. If you read 1 Samuel chapter 9, verses 1 to 2, that's where Saul is introduced, and we find that there is a man of Benjamin whose name is Kish, and he has a son named Saul. So you sort of get that family tree. Those become really familiar names. And then if you get to 2 Samuel chapter 16, verses 5 through 8, when David is on the throne but having some trouble, he ends up being cursed while he's out sort of wandering around with some of his men, by a man named Shimei. So another name that is in these verses. And Shimei is upset with David because he considers him a usurper, having taken the throne from his ancestor, Saul. Which is an interesting thing that Shimei would kind of appear as an echo here, because part of the tension of that narrative in 2 Samuel is whether David should answer this insult by killing the person who has so insulted him. And since he's the descendant of one of his enemies, Saul, that would make sense for him to do. But David shows mercy, and so Shimei lives to fight another day, and his descendant Mordecai ends up playing this heroic role. Mordecai and Esther, since they're in the same family, end up playing this heroic role in the book that's named for Esther. It is an interesting theme on whom should we have mercy as this book develops, because we do get to quite a bit of blood and gore in the later chapters. So, but it's a pivotal thing that David has let this line of Saul continue, because that's the only reason the Jews in exile have a Mordecai and an Esther to ultimately depend on and save them from the coming calamity. Just a fun thing in the Hebrew here, that I'm I'm going to guess you've got the New Revised, some of you have the New Revised Standard Version in front of you like I do. Verse 6 actually begins with just who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives. And so a lot of translations helpfully sort of say that this was Kish. Kish was carried away, this ancestor of Mordecai, because if it had been Mordecai himself, then he would be sort of over 100 years old, which is not totally unheard of in Old Testament narratives, but it's one of those things that translators like to help smooth out for us. Anyway, somebody was carried away from Jerusalem. We also meet Hadassah, which she will never be referred to as again. She's going to be Esther from here on out, which again is a conceit that we're sort of familiar with from the book of Daniel. Jews getting new names when they're in exile. So the characters we all know as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had earlier unpronounceable names that nobody really remembers because they just become Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And in this case, the names that Mordecai and Esther get, and we don't really know what Mordecai's original name was. We know Esther was Hadassah. But these new names that they get actually echo two Mesopotamian gods that are really, really quite well known in this time. Mordecai echoes the name Marduk, and Esther echoes the name Ishtar. So again, it's sort of the question of these very, you know, pagan, worldly, non-Jewish entities becoming Jewish characters. And this is one of the explanations that I ultimately find unsatisfying as to why God's name doesn't appear in the book, because some scholars have argued that, well, because of who these characters are, you can sort of see echoes of Ishtar and Marduk. So really all this is a sort of Jewish telling of a pagan myth. And we know it's just embarrassing that that got into the Old Testament, and no wonder the author didn't actually stick God's name to it, because that would just be, you know, embarrassment upon embarrassment to actually attach the divine name to this rubbish. I find that really unsatisfying for a lot of reasons. But there are interesting echoes. There are interesting ways that Marduk and Ishtar's story gets retold in the story of Mordecai and Esther. Marduk is a god who eventually works his way up in the rank of gods by destroying the god of chaos, Tiamat, the dragon. And of course, there are no dragons necessarily in the Book of Esther, unless you're reading the Septuagint, unless you're reading the Greek, which we noted yesterday has some bits that aren't in the Hebrew and that aren't in the Protestant Bible that we're looking at today. The Greek version of Esther actually starts with exactly a battle between two dragons. Mordecai has a dream that two dragons fight, and he doesn't know what it means necessarily, but by the end it becomes clear that one of the dragons is him, and one of the dragons is a character that we have not met yet, but will today, the great enemy of the Jews, Haman. So that's a pretty pointed reference to Marduk's story, the defeat of the dragon.
Marduk, M-A-R-D-U-K-E?
Yeah, M-A-R-D-U-K is how I usually see it spelled. But they don't use my alphabet, so who knows. Marduk is the Mesopotamian god who defeats chaos and ends up creating the world from there. More interesting, though, is actually Ishtar's backstory. She was the goddess of fertility and beauty and the fates, which are very big themes in Esther. We've already run across the first beauty contest. Women are being sort of summoned and gathered so the king can pick a new queen, and Esther is, spoiler alert, in the verses we're about to read today, she's going to win because she is just lovely and everybody thinks so. So having the Mesopotamian goddess of beauty echoed in the name of this Jewish heroine is an interesting touch. But she's also the goddess of the fates, which, according to this background mythology, are determined by casting lots. And Ishtar is the person, the goddess, who does that. So it's an interesting sort of re-narration, because Esther actually isn't the person who casts the Purim, the lots that determine the fate of the Jews in this story, but she does fast and petition the king. And so it could be a suggestion that the Ishtar who changes the fates in this story, rather than simply taking control of the lots, pleads with the king, who may or may not represent sort of allegorically the king of the universe, on behalf of the chosen people of God, of the universe. And so maybe it's not just a retelling of the Mesopotamian myths, but a reframing, so that the goddess of love and allure is actually pointing us to the fact that love and allure and beauty always point back to the God who loved his creation and who chose this people of Israel. And the fates that, you know, sort of determine what happened to us are ultimately not simply blind fates that can be changed arbitrarily, but it all goes back to the decrees of an eternal God, and two of which are sort of eternal. The decree that, you know, we encounter in the garden, having disobeyed the divine, you know, we would be subject to death. But also the eternal decree that we encounter in Christ. So a decree of death and a decree of life seems to be echoed in these two decrees that we're going to encounter over the course of the book of Esther. So it's just an interesting, I mean, that's why I find it unsatisfying that there would be just the idea that, well, this is a semi-Jewish retelling. I think it's a drastically Jewish retelling of a Mesopotamian myth, sort of framing the creation that we muck around in and sort of make our own stories from to reveal actually what the God of the universe is very much up to. Anyway, so now we've met our heroes. Let's see what's going to happen to them. If somebody could read verse 8 of chapter 2 and take us all the way to verse 18.
So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in the citadel of Susa in custody of Haggai, Esther was taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Haggai, who had charge of the women. The girl pleased him and won his favor, and he quickly provided her with her cosmetic treatments and her portion of food, and with 7 chosen maids from the king's palace, and advanced her and her maids to the best place in the harem. Esther did not reveal her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had charged her not to tell. Every day, Mordecai would walk around in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and how she fared. The turn came for each girl to go in to King Ahasuerus after being 12 months under the regulation for the women, since this was the regular period for their cosmetic treatment, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with perfumes and cosmetics for women. When the girl went into the king, she was given whatever she asked for to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she went in. Then in the morning, she came back to the second harem in custody of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She did not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her, and she was summoned by name. When the turn came for Esther, daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had adopted her as her own daughter, to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. Now Esther was admired by all who saw her. When Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus in his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the other women. Of all the virgins, she won his favor and devotion, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great banquet to all his officials and ministers, Esther's banquet. He also granted a holiday to the provinces and gave gifts with royal liberality.
Thank you. And if you weren't here yesterday, do know it's okay to laugh at this book. because I'll just actually start with something that we find out in verse 16. It is the 7th year of the reign of this king when this takes place, when he welcomes Esther and crowns her his new queen. If you're keeping track at home, it was the 3rd year of his reign when he put away his first wife. So we kind of can wonder, it's been 4 years of doing what? Giving women cosmetic treatments that last a year and visiting with them for one night. And then on to the next. So it's possible that it took him like a week to get over Vashti and start this process, but it's 4 years later when Esther actually becomes queen. So we can just sort of wonder about that. And of course, a year of cosmetic treatments is just, I mean.
It's kind of standard, isn't it?
Right, yeah. it's also, I mean, it's interesting to note that one of the things that was done with the, just as far as the goddess Ishtar, there was a statue to her, and right before her feast, they would sort of perfume the statue. So another subtle echo of that myth going on here. But yeah, what in the world is going on? So Esther goes through this process. Interestingly, the text is very polite. She doesn't sort of put herself forward for the contest. It always says, it says in verse 8, it echoes it again later, she was taken into the gathering of the young women. She was taken, that passive voice. So there's the suggestion that she's sort of the reluctant submission as the new queen of Persia. What else is
interesting? That would appeal to the king after Vashti too.
Oh yeah, somebody very submissive and obedient.
Yeah,
that's a very good point. And in fact, that's the characterization we get of her, in as much as she does whatever the king's eunuch tells her. In verse 15, again, she asked for nothing except when it was her turn to go into the king. She asks for nothing except what this particular eunuch who had charge of the women, who seems to like her, advised. And this goes so well that we're forced to sort of reflect that, okay, all of the sexual secrets of cosmopolitan Susa are in the possession of someone who cannot use them, a eunuch. And he gives really good advice, apparently. We don't know what it was, but it sure worked for Esther.
It's going to make an HBO movie out of it.
I think they have.
There's a veggie tale.
I mean, there's nothing, you can be the royal queen without getting married. There's nothing marriage here or anything.
Well, that's, they sort of think that that's what Esther's banquet is in verse 18, as she does become the new queen. But no, absolutely. I mean, he doesn't need a queen. He seems to go 4 years between Vashti and Esther with just concubines. So that system seems to work out well for him, too. But Esther certainly gets elevated by the end of this chapter, in the seventh year of his reign. In the month of Tebeth, the 10th month, which is sort of in December and January, and when Venus becomes visible in that part of the world, Venus having a correlation with Ishtar. So another sort of echo of that original myth. I just think that the readers of this text who are not Jewish, for whom that, you know, set of mythology might have been more important, we're supposed to recognize certain things should they ever come across this story. So all those echoes are really interesting. Another thing that we're beginning to see here, she was admired by all who saw her. Grace, inexplicable, is just starting to enter this story. We're not really told why Esther, we're told she was beautiful. She seems nice and obedient, having been raised by Mordecai and putting up with this beauty contest business. But we're not really told why she is so loved. She simply is. Which is something that sort of hovers over a lot of the heroes of the Old Testament. There's just, you know, second born, elevated. God just loves Israel. It's not really explained why. They were a stubborn folk. But that's their story. So moving on. Let's finish out chapter 2. Starting at verse 19 and going through the end of that chapter. What's the first thing that's going to happen after Esther becomes queen?
When the virgins were assembled the second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. But Esther had kept secret her family background and nationality, just as Mordecai had told her to do. For she continued to follow Mordecai's instructions, as she had done when he was bringing her up. During the time Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, became angry and conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. But Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. And when the report was investigated and found to be true, the two officials were hanged on the gallows. All this was recorded in the book of the Annals of the Presence of the King.
Okay. The question here actually is, who is Joseph, Mordecai, or Esther? Esther has not revealed her kindred or her people under Mordecai's charge. That's not the first time we've seen that happen in the Old Testament. It's not the first time that a Jew who initially passes as a Gentile in a foreign court eventually uses his or her high status to rescue his or her endangered people. Joseph rises to prominence in Pharaoh's court and ends up saving his family, who, you know, jerks that they were, sold him into slavery in the first place, from a famine. Moses, too, is sort of raised in Pharaoh's court and ultimately uses his Hebrew identity to lead the Hebrew people out of Egypt, out of slavery. So this is a role that Esther is sort of taking on by not revealing her heritage. And then we get this story of these two eunuchs, these two servants of the king, who become angry and conspire to assassinate him. And whose plot is discovered. Joseph, too, ended up in prison because of, well, stuff. We'll actually get to that later in this story. But he ends up with two officials of Pharaoh who are also in prison, one of whom ends up being pardoned and one of whom doesn't. So they clearly had different backstories. But this idea of the role of a Jewish person in revealing the fate of those people is again a sort of deliberate echo of the Joseph narrative coming up here in this book. So Esther gets one, Mordecai gets one. And moving to chapter 3, we can meet our enemy. One thing, so I pronounce it Haman, we can fight over how it's pronounced, but If we were reading this again in the sort of setting of celebrating the festival of Purim, it wouldn't matter how his name was pronounced by any of us because everybody would have little noisemakers in their hands, and whenever we get to his name, you sound them because we are going to obliterate his name from memory as enemy of the Jews. So that's a fun thing that, had I done a little more advanced planning, could have passed out a bunch of shakers. But instead, let's go ahead and meet Haman, enemy of the Jews. I'll read just verse 1 and then give you some background, and then we'll read a longer chunk of the text. So after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman. Son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the officials who were with him. Now, if these echoes of the Joseph narrative that we're starting to see are at all specific, then this sort of echoes Exodus 1:8, which is where we hear that now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph, so who did not necessarily know the great service that this Jewish person had done for Pharaoh. And Haman is not particularly appreciative, nor does Ahasuerus remember necessarily what Mordecai has done in service to the realm. But there's an even more deliberate reference here, not to the Joseph narrative, but to Mordecai's other great ancestor, Saul. Being an Agagite gives Haman a very particular identity. So let's meet him. I'm going to read a horrible story to you. They are around. 1 Samuel 15, if you want to follow along. Now Samuel said to Saul, The Lord sent me to anoint you king over his people Israel. Now therefore listen to the words of the Lord. The Lord, thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish the Amalekites for what they did in opposing the Israelites when they came up out of Egypt. Now go and attack Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have. Do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. So Saul summoned the people and numbered them in Telaim, 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 soldiers of Judah. Saul came to the city of Amalek, of the Amalekites, and lay in wait in the valley. Saul said to the Kenites, go, leave, withdraw from among the Amalekites, or I will destroy you with them. For you showed kindness to the people of Israel when they came up out of Egypt. The story that's being referred to, if you remember the great battle where Moses wins by lifting up his hands, and as long as they keep his hands in the air, the armies of Israel prevail, the folk that they're fighting are the Amalekites. And this has stuck in the memory of the writers of the Old Testament, that the Amalekites harassed Israel coming out of Egypt in this way.
So that's an Amalekites of the same?
Yes, yeah. So that's what's going on here. Whenever it's said that the Amalekites harassed Israel coming out of Egypt, it's that battle. Now Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah as far as Shur, which is east of Egypt, and he took King Agag of the Amalekites alive. But he utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. Now Saul and the people spared Agag, and the best of the sheep and of the cattle and of the fatlings and the lambs, and all that was valuable, and would not utterly destroy them. All that was despised and worthless, they utterly destroyed. This is when Saul loses, and the Lord starts looking at David. It's with this disobedience of the prophet Samuel's words to destroy everything when Saul makes a judgment call and says, well, we're going to keep the good stuff. We'll just destroy the stuff that's worth destroying. It's a really difficult story to understand, just in terms of, I mean, I get sad that mouse traps here at Holden are effective. So so utterly destroying man, woman, child, and all of the creatures of Amalek does, you know.
And the night in my room, you won't be sad.
I saw the effective mouse trap outside of their room. I'm sad. We could live in harmony, or not. Anyway. But these aren't mice. These are people. And so it's a slightly harder story by degrees to understand. Now the word of the Lord came to Samuel, I regret that I made Saul king, for he has turned back from following me and has not carried out my commands. Samuel was angry, and he cried out to the Lord all night. Samuel rose early in the morning to meet Saul, and Samuel was told, Saul went to Carmel, where he set up a monument for himself, and on returning, he passed on down to Gilgal. When Samuel came to Saul, Saul said to him, may you be blessed by the Lord. I have carried out the command of the Lord. But Samuel said, what then is the bleating of sheep in my ears and the lowing of cattle that I hear?
Busted.
Saul said, they have brought them from the Amalekites. For the people spared the best of the sheep and the cattle to sacrifice to the Lord your God.
Yeah, that's it.
It's a sacrifice. But the rest we have utterly destroyed, like you told me to. Then Samuel said to Saul, stop. I will tell you what the Lord said to me last night. And he replied, speak. Samuel said, though you are little in your own eyes, are you not the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel, and the Lord sent you on a mission and said, go, utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until you are consumed. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil and do what was evil in the sight of the Lord? Saul said to Samuel, I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. I have gone on the mission on which the Lord sent me. I have brought Agag, the king of Amalek, and I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But from the spoil, the people took sheep and cattle, the best of the things devoted to destruction, to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal. The story ends, the chapter ends, with Samuel going ahead and carrying out the execution of Agag in the presence of Saul. But there's an Agagite still loose by the Book of Esther. So Saul's disobedience has consequences. Saul's mercy, even if it was just for a time, has consequences for the people of Israel. Anyway, that's Agag, and now we have met his descendant, who will be the great enemy of the Jews. Let's read together, keep going in chapter 3, verses 2 through 6.
And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and did obeisance to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or do obeisance. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you disobey the king's command?" When they spoke to him day after day, and he would not listen to them, they told Haman, in order to see whether Mordecai's words would avail, for he had told them that he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or do obeisance to him, Haman was infuriated. But he thought it beneath him to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So having been told who Mordecai's people were, Haman plotted to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus.
This is the second time in this story that a sort of personal slight, first Vashti not coming when her husband asked her to come, and now Mordecai not bowing down and doing obeisance to this official, has resulted in something that had really far-reaching effects. I mean, it's not just Vashti who was punished. There was that stupid edict about all women being subject to their husbands throughout the kingdom by order of the king in chapter 1. And now we have Haman, Boo Hiss, plotting against the entire people of the Jews, the entire people of Mordecai. So this is just a fine set of folks who have their priorities straight and don't overreact to anything. We don't know what Mordecai's problem is. It could have been a family thing. He may have been very fully aware of Haman's family tree and his own. And it could have been, you know, just the, what are they, the Hatfields and McCoys going on here. It could also be that bowing down and doing obeisance is a little too much respect, is the sort of thing that's only owed to God, which would sort of put Mordecai in a parallel situation to Daniel again, not wanting to do this before anyone except the God of Israel. We don't necessarily know. I mean, we could look at Mordecai's response, but oh, he doesn't give one, just in order to see whether Mordecai's words would avail, whatever those are. We don't know. Again, if you're reading the Greek, Mordecai actually does give an account of himself, but it's not present in this text. This text leaves it pretty ambiguous what Mordecai's actual problem was. The additions to Esther in the Greek and in the Latin do say that Mordecai, well, didn't want to give respect to a person who wasn't God. So that kind of solves that problem for us. But we do know from the text in front of us that whatever Mordecai's problem was, it was tied to his identity as a Jew. We get that in verse 4. Because Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew, and that, for whatever reason, is the explanation of why he won't obey the king's command with regard to this person, Haman. They spoke to him day after day, and he would not listen to them, is another subtle verbal echo. There's another person who spoke to someone day after day and would not be listened to. That happens in Genesis 39:10, when Joseph is in the house of Potiphar with, what is Potiphar's wife's name?
Mrs.
Mrs. Potiphar, exactly. That's a good Old Testament joke. She's just Potiphar's wife. She doesn't get her own name because that's her point in the story. She's trying to seduce Joseph and he says no. So despite the fact that she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not consent to lie beside her or to be with her. So Mordecai is again in this sort of parallel situation. where they spoke to him day after day, tried to persuade him to do this thing, and he says no. Okay, so the result of Haman's plotting and scheming, in both cases, in both the case of Joseph not listening to Potiphar's wife, and now the case of Mordecai not wanting to bow down and do obeisance to Haman, we're going to get a catastrophe for the innocent party. Continuing in on verse 7, let's go from verse 7 to verse 15 of chapter 3. Don't make me do it. I get
in
tired.
The first month, which is the month of Nisan, I bought one once. And the 12th year of the king Ashurus, they cast Hur, which means the lot, before Haman for the day and for the month. And the lot fell on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. And Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered and separated among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws. So it is not appropriate for the king to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued for their destruction. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, so that they may put it into the king's treasuries. So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. The king said to Haman, the money is given to you and the people as well, to do with them as it seems good to you. 215, was it?
Yeah, please.
Then the king's secretaries were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and an edict, according to all that Haman commanded, was written to the king's satraps and to the governors over all the provinces and to the officials of all the peoples, to every province in its own script and every people in its own language. It was written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's ring. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces, giving orders to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province by proclamation, calling on all the peoples to be ready for that day. The couriers went quickly by order of the king, and the decree was issued in the citadel of Susa. The king and Haman sat down to drink. But the city of Susa was still in confusion.
Okay. So I mentioned the question of mercy earlier in terms of David having mercy on that belligerent descendant of Saul, who cursed him, and who he didn't kill, who he didn't repay in that way for the insult. And because Saul gets a family line, the Jews get Mordecai. But because of Saul's mercy on Agag, the Jews get an enemy. So it's kind of the classic question of if we could have killed Hitler in 1930 or so, would that have ultimately been ethically right, to sort of spare the suffering that was inflicted on folks? And it's interesting, it's not even funny, but in 1944, Hitler made a speech that referred to the Book of Esther. He said if he was ever overthrown, the Jews could celebrate a second Purim. So he actually sort of knowingly aligned himself with Haman. But that's kind of the question behind this narrative. If Agag had been killed when it was prophesied, when Samuel sort of gave the Lord's word to Saul, could this have been prevented? Would that have been a more merciful thing? an ethical question that I don't feel compelled to necessarily address in full because I'm just not going to get to an answer ever, I doubt. Timing of this is auspicious, though. So now we know the date that the lot was cast for. 12th month, Adar. But what's more interesting still is the date that it was cast, the date that Haman makes this observation that he's going to attack the people of Mordecai, and he's going to cast Purim, he's going to cast lots in order to figure out when to do it. In verse 7, we get the month. We don't necessarily get a day, but it's the month of Nisan. And then we do get a day a little bit further down in verse 12. It may be the same day, it may be a day or so later, but the king's secretaries are summoned to go ahead and promulgate this edict on the 13th day of the month of Nisan. And if you check out the Jewish calendar ever, which you can do if you've got a study Bible, there's probably a table explaining it. It's a lunar calendar, which means it doesn't fully line up with the calendar that's normally used in the West. It kind of appears to move because it's based on lunar cycles. Jews also have leap years, but they don't to sort of align everything with the solar calendar, just, again, like the Western calendar does. But instead of an extra day in February every 4 years, they get an extra month once in a while. So it can get really confusing. But again, there's a table in your in a study Bible if you want to sort of check it out. I also recommend JewFAQ.org, which is a very good resource. Of course that exists. To sort of explain how that calendar works. But if you ever take a look in detail, you'll find that there is something very interesting happening in the month of Nisan, and that is the festival of Passover. So it's the 13th of Nisan when this edict gets published and taken by Persian Pony Express to all the corners of the kingdom. But if you read Exodus chapter 12, or if you have a look at Leviticus chapter, I think it's 23, which explain the festival of Passover, you'll know that it begins on the 14th day of Nisan. So it's the day before Passover that this really horrible thing for the people of Mordecai happens. This really scary edict gets published. And the big question is, will we get another Passover? Will we get the intervention, the saving work of the Lord visible in the community of Israel again? It's not an accident that these dates sort of line up, but it is a very open question. I mean, Old Testament history 101, Esther is taking place past the time of the patriarchs, past the time of Moses and the Passover, past the time of the monarchy under David, under Saul, and then David, and then Solomon, past the division of the monarchy, the split of the two kingdoms into Israel in the north and Judah in the south, past the Assyrian conquest of the northern kingdom, past the Babylonian conquest of the southern kingdom, and past the destruction of Jerusalem and the burning of the temple, which had been central to Jewish worship, and the idea that God, his presence, the very symbol of God's care for Israel in that temple is now gone. This is a question that's wrestled with in various ways for the rest of the Old Testament. Brevard Childs actually had a great line that the Old Testament is best understood and interpreted through the ashes of the temple, trying to figure out how the chosen people of God could undergo this great tragedy and still understand themselves to be the people of God. And that's why, by the time the Persians have knocked the Babylonians out of power and the Israelites are once again just under foreign rule and don't have their own land and don't have their own temple, will God save them? It's certainly the day to do it, but we're going to find out tomorrow. Because it's 4:45.